This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Here's a few of the things my guest Kate Bowler doesn't want to hear about living with her incurable cancer. Everything happens for a reason. God is writing a better story. Heaven is your true home. God needs another angel. It's not that she's lacking in faith. She just wants to avoid trite life lessons. Bowler is an associate professor of the history of Christianity in North America at Duke Divinity School. Her new memoir, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved, is about how her faith has affected the way she deals with cancer and how her cancer has affected her faith. She also reflects on the paradox that her first book was about the history of the prosperity gospel, which preaches that God grants health and wealth to those with the right kind of faith. Bowler was diagnosed in 2015 with stage 4 colon cancer that had already metastasized. She's married, has a young son, and can't bear the thought of him growing up without her. What's kept her alive, in addition to colon surgery and chemo, is experimental immunotherapy treatments that helped shrink her tumors. Kate Bowler, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to ask you to start with a reading from the preface to your book.
Oh, sure. Married in my 20s, a baby in my 30s, I won a job at my alma mater straight out of graduate school. I felt breathless with the possibilities. Actually, it's getting harder to remember what it felt like, but I don't think it was anything as simple as pride. It was certainty, plain and simple, that God had a worthy plan for my life in which every setback would also be a step forward. I wanted God to make me good and make me faithful, with just a few shining accolades along the way. Anything would do if hardships were only detours on my long life's journey. I believed that God would make a way. I don't believe that anymore.
Thank you for reading that. So, listen, after finishing your book, I need to know, how are you now? Where are you in your treatment?
Well, I'm moving from the crisis phase to the chronic illness management phase. So now I get scans repeatedly instead of having regular treatment. And it requires a different kind of mentality. Before, it felt like it was alarm bells all the time. And now it's just sort of a distant alarm sound and a general sense of anxiety.
So what is the state of the cancer?
Well, I have incurable cancer. So the hope is just that it doesn't grow and that the treatment I'm on keeps it at bay. And the goal with new developments in immunotherapy is that it could be like that forever and that cancer might eventually be a chronic illness. But we're so early on in immunotherapy as a treatment that no one really knows.
So in the book, there's a period where you're starting the immunotherapy treatment and you get scans,
yeah.
I think, every 2 months?
Yeah, that still happens every 3 months.
Yeah, and so after each one, you were basically told, you've got another 2 months or 3 months for
yes.
sure of life. But that was the only certainty you had. Are you in that
yeah.
same kind of period where you're living from short interval to short interval with no certainty beyond that?
Well, before it was especially terrifying because with the experimental drug I was on, if the tumors grew, I knew I would get kicked out of the trial, and that would be pretty much it for me. So thankfully now it's scan to scan feels slightly less terrifying.
Well, since your book is about how your religious scholarship and religious practice is affecting how you cope with the illness, and it's about how the illness is affecting your understanding of God, let's start with religion. And let's start with a religion that you were immersed in for research, the prosperity
yeah.
gospel, which was the subject of your doctoral dissertation and of your first book. So I want to start with that, and I'll need you to describe what the prosperity gospel is.
Sure. The prosperity gospel is a movement that grew out of Pentecostalism that said that God rewards the faithful with health and wealth within the course of their human life if they have the right kind of faith.
So in the prosperity gospel, there's a direct connection between your prayers and how you are rewarded by God. The rewards are money and material possessions as well as good health. So what does it mean within that creed if you get sick, like you've gotten sick?
Well, that's the double-edged sword of a movement like the prosperity gospel. For people who experience tough times, it really can be tremendously empowering for a preacher to say, look, You might be experiencing the pitfalls, but there is a cure. You just have to speak, positively confess, is what they would say, your faith aloud, and you will name and claim these incredible miracles. But of course, the flip side is that for those who experience persistent misfortune, the only conclusion that they can then draw is that they're not faithful enough.
In the preface to your book, you write, "I believed God would make a way. I don't believe that anymore." But you still believe in God. You haven't lost your faith.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a super Jesus-y heart over here. I do. I mean, it's so funny. It's just that I really had to rethink what trust and hope looks like if I'm just living scan to scan. Like, what does it mean to experience, I don't know, proximity to God or a sense of faithfulness without actually thinking that my life is supposed to be better because of it? Like, I don't know if a lot of people think this, but at least the hope is, like, if you're a good Christian or you're a good anybody, that, like, maybe you will somehow get some sort of advantage, at least in terms of spiritual enrichment or, you know, life-changing perspective. And in the end, like, I don't know if there's really any advantage to being spiritual, except that you get to know a little something about the presence of God.
Have you asked God to heal you? Do you believe that that's something you can ask for, and that's something, that it's something that God can decide to do? Like, let us
heal
this person.
I do, yeah. I like to be open to lovely things happening, just as now I'm trying to be open to the idea that terrible things happen. The prosperity gospel movement comes out of the Pentecostal movement of the early 20th century, and they were all about signs and wonders and God just showing up and surprising you. And I felt like I learned something about not being so heavily, I don't know, rationalistic or something, that I assume that the world always operates in this very predictable way. So I'm open to being surprised, and I pray for, man, from second one, I prayed for health, and I went through a very robust bargaining phase, which I was like, dear God, please, please save me. I will do anything. But I don't also then expect that just because I prayed it or because I'm spiritually trying hard that it's going to work out.
So you grew up surrounded by Mennonites in Manitoba, Canada. Your husband is Mennonite. You went to a Mennonite camp. Were you offered ways from that community to understand sickness?
Yeah, that is maybe one of my favorite things about Mennonites, is they sort of expect life to be grisly and grueling and horrible in some way that I find really refreshing. They always have this big coffee table book called The Martyr's Mirror, which is this really gruesome 17th century account of people's early Mennonites' horrible deaths. And I find that very compelling because they have stories circulating within memory of life not being fair, and that part of the solution to that is community.
And if you take a kind of life is hard worldview, then when someone in that community gets sick, they're not the outlier. They're not disproving
right.
The presence of God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I mean, they've always been committed to simplicity, pacifism, ruining Jell-O salads with deli meat just buried in there somewhere like a horrible surprise. They're really not expecting much in the healthiest way, because they assume that most things have to be done together, and that those who suffer are just experiencing one of the many pitfalls of this life.
So have your prayers changed, or has the place of prayer or the meaning of prayer in your life changed?
I think maybe it has, because I think I don't have the luxury of being too sophisticated anymore. I mean, you just get infected with this urgency that comes with facing your death. And so I pray for very basic things. Please, God, make me kind and open to the pain of the world. Please, God, heal me. Make me less of a dink. And help me be a good mom and a wife. I mean, just really basic stuff, as opposed to maybe the more layered prayers that I was raised with or learned in theological school, which always have long gerund phrases like ever-loving and ever-living God. I come to you and like, there's no dignity now. I just go right for it.
You quote in your book something a friend with cancer said to you. They said, I have known Christ in so many good times, and now I will know him better in his sufferings. That obviously stuck with you. And it's similar to something that you say in the book, which is that you have to seek God in the darkness and brokenness now.
Yeah.
So can you elaborate on that?
Well, I mean, and this was part of the maybe spiritual excavation project that I started to see this book as, where I didn't write the book because I thought, you know, I have a lot of really important things to share with other people. I initially wrote it because I was trying to get down to the deepest, hardest, truest things that I believed, like get down to those lies that I had perpetuated all along, that I needed to be shiny to be worthy of God's love and the attention of others, and that I needed to achieve and be master and commander of my, you know, everything. And so part of not being shiny, it was me coming to terms with my own frailty, the fact that I probably wasn't going to be able to piece things together, and learning to feel spiritually, I guess, accepted by God and by other people when I didn't have much to offer people anymore.
So you write in your book, I am preparing for death and everyone else is on Instagram.
Yeah. I was trying not to be the worst about that, but like it was weird to be 35 and I have this little kid. And when you look at your kid, I think they just look like the future. You know, like everything about them is possibility and milestones and what you imagine they'll be. And everyone I knew, it was living in that world of endless possibility. And it was really depressing sometimes to feel like I was always mentally trying to wrap things up.
Your son was 2 years old when you were diagnosed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just turned two. I just saw pictures the other day and I have to admit that pictures still make me feel really sad. Like, I think I just, like, it's hard not to remember so clearly, like, he was too little. He was too little to lose me. And it's this feeling of endless gratitude I have every time I look at him, like, oh, he is aging. I am doing this.
Do you think that his presence in your life affected your willingness to take on some really harsh therapies?
I think that's right. I think he is the most hopeful thing I can imagine. And he is a perfect reason to try to be as brave as possible within the confines of my day. Like every day is some possibilities and some inevitabilities. And it is really hard to figure out which are which because sometimes you're so tired. Like chemotherapy made me feel really cold. Really?
You mean physically cold? You became very sensitive to the cold.
Yeah, just physically
cold.
Yeah, I was freezing. I'm freezing all the time. Thanks, chemotherapy. Yeah, it makes you feel really fragile. And then you have this permanent thing, which is your love. And like that feeling makes you want to do anything. And so it made me write a book, like something I never would have had the hubris to do before. It made me try to make my world as big and as ridiculous as possible. And I think so much of that is just the feeling I get when I look at him.
So at one point you asked your sister-in-law to promise you that she would tell your husband to get remarried if you died, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. that you didn't want your death if you die to end his life as well as your own. So this is a hard subject to broach, so if you don't want to talk about that, that's fine.
No, it's fine.
But thinking about the possibility of him, of you being gone and him remarrying and your son having a different mother, I think that that's probably pretty unbearable to think about. I know you
I think, it's impossible. I mean, it really comes across as an impossible thought. Like, not that other people can love, that the people you love can love other things. You want that. You want more of that. But the idea that they would go on without you, oh, like it was impossible to conceive of. I mean, part of it felt weirdly, the part that was easy was a reflection of the confidence that I have, especially in the man I married. Man, he is so good. And he is exceptionally pretty. And I thought, oh, you'll be fine. Like, you're so good looking. You'll be fine. I give it a month before someone's like, oh, knocking at the door. But I think it just seemed inconceivable to imagine really coming to the end of myself. And so the hope was always that, and I mean, that's why I was begging my sister-in-law, is like that people have to come alongside and try to imagine new worlds for the people that you would do anything for.
And to put aside your jealousy and envy, the kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That kind of naturally go along with imagining your spouse with somebody else. I mean,
oh yeah, no
one wants to do that. Yeah.
Well, luckily, I have so thoroughly just ruined my family dynamics with how involved I am. I mean, who could live without me at this point? They've known me since I was 14, so I've just ruined everything. I will be in every picture, but I'll be totally honest. Like, that was one of my saddest early thoughts. Is I remember thinking like, should I be in this picture? Like, won't it be so hard for the person after me? And like, that's the stuff you never say out loud. Like, you never say that because it is so depressing. But the truth of it is, like, your love makes you want to imagine worlds for them, even if it doesn't include you.
It seems to me that you don't need to be worrying about how someone else in the future might feel if you're in a family photo.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Your brain is just so, because I remembered it yesterday for the first time, like my reluctance to keep living because I imagined, you're just doing triage right away. You're just doing triage on everything. The other weird thing I think your brain does is it assumes that you can save yourself or someone else some kind of future pain. Like, I think maybe that's just what love does. But you take on these imaginative exercises. Like, I mean, I started giving stuff away that I thought my husband wouldn't want. Right away, I thought like, whoa, we have too many books. This is stupid. I'm an academic. I've destroyed this health with books. We should get rid of all these books. And it was my attempt to start slowly erasing myself. And that is just, you know, I've talked to people who say it took them a year to buy clothes because they can't imagine still having their body. And that was true for me, too.
And now?
I got to wear a dress the other day that I had in a box because it was my teaching dress. And I got to wear it at my book launch event and get my hair done. And I thought, wow, thank you. I am so grateful to be fancy instead of just in rough cotton in a hospital somewhere. So it felt good.
You've had a lot of like bad reactions to the harsh chemo that you've had to take. And then there's the experimental immunotherapy drug. So you've had lockjaw, you've lost sensation in your hands and feet, mouth ulcers, hypersensitivity to cold. And you're right, it's increasingly hard to remember that these side effects are not the same as dying. Pain like that can be so distracting, at the very least. I mean, how do you get your mind off of just feeling all the pain?
Yeah.
When you're in one of those periods when you're feeling that.
Yeah, because the pain, it really does feel like it's like a noise and it's too loud and other people are trying to talk to you and you can't quite hear them. It's, at least that's how my pain feels to me. So I'm part of my hope for writing and for, I've been teaching this year and parenting, and I spend a lot of time with my friends, is I need to make sure that my world stays as large as possible to minimize the space that cancer and that pain takes up. So part of my attempts to be a bigger person maybe than I would have been before, make my life take up more space, is an attempt to deal with how terrible chronic pain is. But also, I think I should just admit that I am the worst. Like, I wrote this book in an attempt to understand my own pathological need to assume everything's always getting better. And then, as a response, I never take a nap. I never take a break. I mean, I really am refusing to learn lessons that I have been trying to learn for some time.
Are you in pain now?
Oh, usually. Yeah, I think so. I don't think about it, but yeah. If I actually was quiet for a second and thought about it, I think the answer would be yes.
Do you have any concept of what happens after life? Like, do you believe in heaven and hell? Do you have a concept of what that would be?
Well, I believe in heaven. But I have mixed feelings about it, if I can say that honestly. I mean, people were so quick to say that, like, this is the great reward, right? Like, heaven's going to be amazing, and to maybe minimize the fear of death. But I always felt really resentful of that right away, because at least for me, if I was gone, I just thought, well, then I'm going to miss everything. So heaven wasn't, I know a lot of people get very interested in heaven, especially if they've had someone pass away, or, but I always thought, well, that's just not here. Like, not with all the things I love. So I wasn't very interested.
You know, there's one sentence in the book where you write, life is beautiful, life is hard. And yeah. I think that's a great summary statement. Simple and true.
It's just this little loop that my brain goes on. I mean, like, you can see, because it's the two things at the same moment. Like, when you're in the hospital and you've got a face mask on and you can taste that, like, brine of the awful fluids that they've just pumped into your body, and you look around and you just see something so beautiful. Like, the way an old man reaches over to, like, adjust his wife's hair as she gets her treatment. And their love just makes you stop for a second. I see it every day, like something that is just heart-stoppingly beautiful.
Kate Bowler, it's really just been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh my word, what a gift. Thank you.
Kate Bowler's new memoir is called Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. She teaches at Duke Divinity School. The new superhero movie Black Panther has a new soundtrack album on which rapper Kendrick Lamar plays a prominent role. His album Damn was our rock critic Ken Tucker's number one album of 2017. Here's Ken's review of the soundtrack.
That song, Pray For Me, is a collaboration between Kendrick Lamar and The Weeknd. That's The Weeknd supplying the vocal you just heard. It's the most conventional movie music on this soundtrack album, a big dramatic ballad to set the mood. Compare that to the opening cut on the album, which Lamar delivers from the point of view of the Black Panther himself.
All hail the king!
I dropped a million tears. I know several responsibilities put me here. I don't pedal backwards, but I live old-fashioned. The lens that I'm looking through won't prescribe you the right glasses. Masses are now free. Ashes I'm dumping out about to spread all across seas. Sisters and brothers in unison, not because of me. Because we don't glue with the opposition. We glue with peace, but still up your organization. If any beef, what do you stand for? Are you an activist? What are your city plans for? Are you an accident? Are you just in the way? Your native tongue contradicting what your body language say? Are you a king? Are you joking? Are you a king? Are you posing? Are you a king? Are you smoking? To keep you open, because a king don't cry, king don't die, king don't lie, king get for king get by kingdom for kingdom come when I come, you know why?
King, I am T'Challa.
That lonely sounding repeated piano figure suggests the isolation of a besieged hero. The build-in tension, as Lamar's voice echoes off the sides of the melody, introduces more drama. It's Lamar's original take on how to illustrate a comic book movie through music. Like so many soundtrack albums, this one aims to include some hit singles that will help promote the movie. Lamar has already scored a big one with this duet with the singer SZA called all the stars.
Maybe the night that my tears might let me know all the stars are gold, sure.
Nothing new to me. You could bring a bullet, bring a sword, bring a morgue, but you can't bring the truth to me. You and all your expectations, I don't even want your congratulations. I recognize your false confidence and calculated promises all in your conversation. I hate people that feel entitled.
The Black Panther comic books I read as a kid featured T'Challa, who was king of the African nation of Wakanda, as well as being the masked hero Black Panther. He's both a dignified leader of people and a cool costume superhero, torn between these two responsibilities. Kendrick Lamar has clearly thought about the internal strife of T'Challa as he helped to compose the moody ruminations in Bloody Waters, a track featuring the vocals of Anderson .Paak.
Stays in, all that stays in. I don't keep it, I won't be here for it. All those days in, all that stays in. I don't keep it, though I won't be here for it.
Yes, Lord, Hail Mary's in the sky. False prophets get buried alive. Head on the throne, cause that's where I reside. Ways of the world, the weak won't survive. Something's in the water, hey, my, we lawless. Please move with caution, who said the fairway? Damn right I need all this. Yeah, Jack, I need all this. Yeah,
it's over here with fingerprints on the screen. And we gon' make it like two-thirds of the box.
There's a wide range of music on this album. Lamar invites other musicians from his record label Top Dog Entertainment to contribute music to which he adds vocals, hooks, and rhymes. In addition, there's Vince Staples, who continues the sonic experiments he started on last year's album Big Fish Theory with a new song called Ops. And the up-and-coming British vocalist Georgia Smith sounds great singing against the strange, draggingly slow beat of the song I Am.
Somebody's always gonna say something. Try and shoot me down for voicing my own opinion. Triggering a part of me that's always been indifferent. And I know that we have asked for change. Don't be scared to put the fist to shame. When you know I you.
The level on which Kendrick Lamar connects to a superhero like Black Panther is in identifying with the struggle of a protagonist who faces not only enemies trying to oppress him, but also internal struggles, conflicting emotions, and temptations. And with almost superheroic strength, musical strength that is, he turns all of this into sounds that are shrewd, passionate, and almost ridiculously entertaining.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed the soundtrack album for the new movie Black Panther. Coming up, we talk with long-haul trucker Finn Murphy about life on the road. He's written a new memoir. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I drive a compact car, so I was interested in hearing about life driving a 70,000-pound truck whose trailer is 53 feet long. My guest, Finn Murphy, has written a new memoir called The Long Haul about his experiences logging over 1,000,000 miles. His cargo includes the furniture, dishes, clothing, pianos, heirlooms, and artwork of corporate executives and their families moving across the country to new homes for their new jobs. Murphy typically packs and unpacks the possessions as well. His memoir is filled with insights about life on the road and the subculture of truckers, as well as about the attachments people have to their possessions when they're transitioning to a new home and having to decide what to keep and what to ask Murphy to throw in the dumpster. He's been driving a truck off and on since the late 1970s. He dropped out of college to become a truck driver. Finn Murphy, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start with a reading from the book, a short paragraph from the introduction.
To the casual observer, all trucks probably look similar. And I suppose people figure all truckers do pretty much the same job. Neither is true. There's a strict hierarchy of drivers, depending on what they haul, how they're paid. The most common are the freight haulers. They're the guys who pull box trailers with any kind of commodity inside. We movers are called bedbuggers, and our trucks are called roach coaches. Other specialties are car haulers, we call them parking lot attendants, flatbedders, skateboarders, animal transporters, chicken chokers, refrigerated food haulers, reefers, chemical haulers, thermos bottle holders, and hazmat haulers, suicide jockeys. Bedbuggers are shunned by other truckers. We will generally not be included in conversations around the truck stop coffee counter or in the driver's lounge. In fact, I pointedly avoid coffee counters when there is one, mostly because I don't have time to waste, but also because I don't buy into the trucker myth that most drivers espouse. I don't wear a cowboy hat, Tony Lama snakeskin boots, or a belt buckle doing free advertising for Peterbilt or Harley Davidson. My driving uniform is a three-button company polo shirt, lightweight black cotton pants, black sneakers, black socks, and a cloth belt. My moving uniform is a black cotton jumpsuit.
Well, thanks for reading that. And apparently you don't wear jeans or belts because they can scratch the furniture.
Yes, that's correct.
So why are long-haul furniture movers at the bottom of the trucker hierarchy?
Because we have to load and unload our trucks first. Second, we have to deal with customers. So as a mover who works for a van line, I'm managing this move and this transition for this family. And that takes a certain amount of diplomacy and tact and social lubrication skills that a lot of drivers don't want to do. And then the third one is we get paid a lot of money to do this. So we're at the top of the earnings pyramid, which puts us sort of at the bottom of the coffee counter trucker pyramid.
So you're not like part of the brotherhood so much?
Not so much, because of the, as I just read in the introduction there, we don't drive, you know, I don't drive 200,000 miles a year. I'm not doing 3,000 miles a week, 52 weeks a year from New Jersey to San Diego. A lot of my time is actually spent loading, unloading, interacting with the customers, and then driving. So they don't, part of the fraternity is, you know, how many miles a year do you do? And we don't do that as many miles as a freight hauling trucker.
So does that translate to being treated by other truckers in a certain way?
It does. Once they see the van line shirt, and it doesn't happen just with truckers either. It happens with waitresses. It happens in the service bays, at the truck washes. The bedbuggers are, we are looked down upon in a certain kind of a way.
So when people hire you to move all their possessions, and mostly you have very high-end clients, they're leaving all their possessions in the world to a stranger. And no matter how, you know, nice and diplomatic and caring you are when you meet them, you're still a stranger. What do people say to you to try to convince you to be nice to their stuff and take good care of it? Because I'm sure there's really like nice ways of doing that and really like threatening ways of doing that.
Yes, so moving hits people right there in that security spot. So when I show up on moving day, in fact, really what happens in the first 5 minutes of a move is almost going to dictate the tenor of how the day is going to go. So people are already, you know, it's very disruptive to a family. It's disruptive to children. It's disruptive to the parents. Usually there's a change in their jobs and so forth. So even before we get there, this is fraught with emotion. And then you know, you've got the reputation of the moving industry, which is, you know, I'm very aware of the dismal view that the general public has about movers. And I try to assuage that as much as possible early on and to let them know that we're professionals, that we care about their things. But that said, some of the crews that I work with, I mean, we're talking about, you know, very big people. Well, there's a lot of tattoos. It's all immigrant laborers. Wonderful, wonderful people. And I have crews all over the country I've been working with for decades. But it can be a kind of unnerving initial physical presence at the beginning.
So you're entrusted with the possessions, and sometimes something goes wrong. And I think, like, the biggest example of that in your book is when you were moving a family and the woman's baby grand piano was like the most prized possession. It was like a family heirloom in addition to being a piano. And it didn't really fit easily into the new home. And it was kind of a catastrophe. Would you describe what happened?
It was a catastrophe. So the three words that all movers live by is "not my fault." And so we had to bring this up an outside staircase. It was a baby grand piano, weighed about 700 pounds. And we were bringing it up the incline just with brute force, which is one of the really attractive things about the work that I do and that we do as moving crews. And so we were just manhandling this thing up. And as we got to the top of the stairs, which was being held by those two sort of metal joist hangers, the joist hangers gave away. The piano fell about 14 feet down onto the ground. All of my movers scattered in all directions. And when the piano hit, it made, you know, remember that chord at the end of the Sgt. Pepper album?
Yes.
When it goes boing. So that's the noise that the piano made. That was its death flurry. And we were all just shocked and standing around. And the customer was there with a toddler in her hand. And then the thunderstorm came and it just started to rain on everything.
That's so horrible.
And myself and my crew, we just looked over at the shipper. We call the customer the shipper. And one of my men, this big giant of a man, went over and put his arm around the customer, the shipper. And then the two of us went over and we all just sort of put our arms around each other, watched the piano get soaking wet in the rain.
So you write that truckers like you aren't sentimental about objects. I'll kind of leave a baby grand out of that because that's an instrument that's different than than an object, in my opinion. But so you're right, you're not sentimental about objects, you don't own much. I could easily see it being the other way around, watching how meaningful possessions are to people. I could see you becoming more attached, not less attached, to things in your life. So why are you less attached?
Because we see objects or stuff in a continuum of the way people live. For example, in your 20s and 30s, most Americans are accumulating things. And then in the 40s and 50s, that sort of levels off. And then in the 60s and 70s, then they're disaccumulating things or eradicating things. So we get to watch the whole continuum. So we see, for example, that the kids' kindergarten drawings that are on the refrigerator, or the high school yearbook, or Aunt Tilly's antique vanity. We see that those things are going to be put into storage at some point, and then when somebody's tired of paying the storage fees, then we're paid to take it and get rid of it. So movers are kind of Buddhist in a way. We sort of understand the transitory nature of man-made things because we're there at the point when it gets thrown away. So even if you can't bring yourself to get rid of your stuff, your heirs or descendants will have no such qualms at all.
Do you ever pick out things that you want for yourself when you're supposed to be putting everything in the dumpster?
No, but we movers get offered things all the time. In fact, so here's the four things that movers get offered most commonly. Pianos, hot tubs, backyard trampolines and pool tables.
Why?
Every mover I know could have six or seven of these things if they wanted to have them.
Why are those the things?
Because they're big and bulky, and depending on where they're moving to, they may or may not have room. They put it on Craigslist, they priced it wrong, and on moving day, it's still there. And then at that point, they just want to get rid of it.
They don't say, I'll leave it for the next family that love having it.
we do that too, because usually we're not taking the hot tub or the backyard trampoline.
Right. What's one of the strangest things that you've had to move?
Probably a collection of Chinese gravestones. This gentleman that I was moving, he had eight of them. Each one was worth $80,000.
Hmm.
He had a gallery set up in the center of this giant house, a 16,000 square foot house in Aspen, Colorado. And he had pedestals custom made. And it was our job to put the gravestones on each of the pedestals. And each one weighed 600 pounds or so. And this shipper, he treated us so badly. This is a house with 11 bathrooms, and he had gotten a porta potty for us to use for during the move that
wow.
was outside.
He's entrusting you with this, you know, fortune's worth of stuff, and he won't even let you use his bathroom or one of his bathrooms?
Right. Yeah. That's how it works.
But
sometimes,
if he's disrespecting you that way, how are you supposed to respect his possessions?
Well, fortunately, movers and restaurant workers have some sort of retaliatory measures to hand.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
So we didn't say anything to him. And he kept going down into town and bringing back food for himself and his wife and people. And anyway, we were starving, and we were using the porta potty, and we were uncreating these gravestones. And one of the things that I had done in my not-so-stellar college career was I had taken a semester of Chinese. So I knew the orientation of the Chinese characters, and I was pretty sure that my shipper didn't. So when we installed his gravestones, we put them in upside down, and he couldn't tell the difference. So we were really looking forward to the day when he was going to have a cocktail party and show off his gravestones, and somebody who was understood Chinese would tell the Philistine that he had them all wrong.
How does a house even support so many 600-pound gravestones?
Well, he had an Olympic pool in the basement, so I imagine it was
made. Oh, my
gosh.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I get to see some pretty amazing places.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the view like when you're riding high up in the cab of a truck? And all the other cars, especially the compact cars like me, are so far below you.
So what people don't seem to understand is that I can see everything. And people tend to think that their automobile is anonymous. And I find that really amusing. So you've got this vehicle with windows all around it and a license plate on it. And you're out in public. It's like the least anonymous thing that you could be doing. But the behavior that people perform inside their vehicles makes it look like they don't think anybody can see. Well, I can see everything. So I know what everybody's doing in their cars. And, you know, Americans, we're pretty good drivers in general. The worst drivers are around D.C. And the best drivers, for some reason, are in Michigan. I'm not quite sure what that is. But if Americans would just drive while they're driving instead of doing something else at driving, that would be a lot better for everybody. And here's what most people are doing in their cars that I can see. They're eating. They're drinking either a legal or an illegal beverage. They're putting on makeup. Texting, obviously. Disciplining kids in the back seat. That's a big one. But most of the time that I can see through the body language is people are working on their relationship with the person in the passenger seat. And sometimes that can be romantic and sweet, which is a nice little treat. And then most of the time, it's conflict.
I thought you were going to say people are picking their noses. I honestly thought that. And I thought something else you were going to say that has to do with body fluids. So, you know.
This is a family show, Terry.
So you've seen that too. You're just not mentioning it.
No, I haven't seen anybody actually eliminating fluids in a car, no. I haven't seen that. I have seen some romantic moments.
Yes. Okay. Well, changing the subject for a second, I have to say a paragraph I particularly enjoyed in your memoir has to do with how you listen to a lot of public radio when you're driving in your truck, and that you know a lot of other truckers who listen to public radio too. And so my personal thanks for that and for a very nice mention of me and our show. But I love that one Klan member from Georgia calls NPR U.S. Jews and Girls Report. That's pretty funny. And as you said, yeah, he might say that, but he listens.
Yeah, he probably doesn't have the mug, though.
We don't know for sure, though, do we?
I don't.
That would be great if he did. So, what do you do when you're starting to fall asleep at the wheel?
It's really easy for me. So for you four-wheeler drivers out there, if you start getting that fluttering of the eyelid thing, then it's really time, it's actually past time to pull over. So see if you can remember that. And when I get that, I pull over. But the easy thing for me is I've got a double bed in the back with 600-count sheets and a feather duvet, and it's tucked in with hospital corners, and I've got a climate control system, and I can take a 15 or 20-minute nap, and actually, I sleep better in the sleeper than I sleep anywhere. I can also pull my truck over, and probably if you pull a car over on the side of the highway, you're probably going to get hassled or somebody's going to wonder what you're doing. But trucks, they just get completely left alone. So I'll take a 20-minute trucker nap right back in my comfy little bed and get back on the road.
All right. Good luck to you with your writing and your driving. And thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been fun.
Thank you, Terry. I'm thrilled to be here.
Finn Murphy's new memoir is called The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tale of Life on the Road.